We want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear.
Hello.
Hi, Stephen. It's Ian Masters here. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. So we can get rolling, I think. If you could just tell me how the weather is. You're in San Francisco?
Foggy.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. How's that sound? Okay, we're good to go. All right. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Stephen Zunis, who is a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, where he chairs the program in Middle East Studies. He serves as a senior policy analyst for the Foreign Policy and Focus Project of the Institute for Policy Studies, an associate editor of Peace Review, a contributing editor to Kuhn, and chair of the Academic Advisory Committee for the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Zunis.
Good to be back.
And we spoke last time at the time of the NATO intervention in the Libyan civil war, and you were on the side of the skeptics about the very nature of the intervention in terms of NATO, and felt that, in fact, had it stayed a nonviolent conflict, the Libyan people would have been better off. What's your take on it now, given that the Libyan people seem to be celebrating a victory?
You know, it's always hard to project, in hindsight, various alternative scenarios. I mean, the bottom line is that it's great that they are freed of Gaddafi. And I also just want to appreciate you for not just, falling into kind of the more knee-jerk, hard-left, conspiratorial view behind the criticisms of the intervention. At the same time, I remain a little nervous, history has shown that dictators overthrown by armed struggles, particularly if they involve heavy foreign intervention, are far more likely than overthrows of dictators by largely nonviolent means to either fall into factional fighting or slide into another dictatorship. There's something about the martial values and military hierarchy that's inherent in armed struggle that tends to carry over to the new regime. One thing gives me a little bit of hope, though, is that this final push, though obviously NATO did play a significant role, did involve a large-scale civil insurrection within Tripoli itself. It wasn't just these forces from the east or marching into the city. In fact, the reason the regime collapsed so quickly was that they were faced with a working-class neighborhoods within Tripoli itself in open rebellion to the regime, which gives the Tripolitanians some ownership of the revolution, and hopefully will be a harbinger for a more pluralistic future.
But Stephen Zunis, that's not to say that there was valid criticism at the time that we last spoke. Indeed, I spoke to Edward Luttwak, who's quite conservative, and his objection to the liberal interventionists, and this was at the time when Hillary Clinton and Susan Rice and Samantha Powell were apparently all weighing in on the president. And the right-wing critique from Edward Luttwak was that there's no consistency in this, in the humanitarian intervention, because after all, there's been an ongoing Holocaust in the Congo, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So that leads you to just tee off from what Luttwak was saying. We're not intervening in the Congo to stop wholesale slaughter of people. Why? Well, I'd hazard a guess that it may have something to do with oil, right?
Yeah, that was certainly one factor. Also, the fact that Gaddafi was pretty vulnerable. I mean, whereas the Congo is a series of different factions going after each other, marauding bands, et cetera, we had a one-man rule, a man who had alienated pretty much everybody, left, right, center, nationalist, Islamist, pretty much everybody by his capricious and arbitrary rule. So I think the folks at NATO really thought it would be a pretty quick and easy kind of a low-risk proposition. Of course, it ended up being anything but. It was long, it was protracted, there was a lot of damage, and undoubtedly there'll still be some bitterness and divisions within Libyan society that it's going to take a while to rebuild and put together. But I think it was ultimately victorious, again, because the people of Libya wanted him out. And I think the military historians and others will argue about, how much was the NATO destruction of the command and control infrastructure and the ability to fly aircraft and whatever, how decisive was that, versus the fact that this did lead to something of a nationalist reaction. The Libyans are among the more xenophobic people in the Arab world, and it may have in many ways solidified his support stronger and for a longer time. So it remains a debate. To Obama's credit, this is not a unilateral American thing brought in. In fact, it was not even led by the United States. There was some sort of UN mandate, though unfortunately I think it went well beyond that. So the mandate, which is simply to protect civilian lives, and I'm a little concerned about the precedent there. But I think it was more a sense that this is something that that intervention could work, whereas many of these other scenarios, it would have been logistically more difficult. But at the same time, I think you're right. Obviously, the great resources that Libya had and strategic location, all that, certainly played a factor as well.
Well, Dr. Stephen-Zunis, it seems to me, though, that there is another explanation that hasn't really been discussed very much, it's my theory, in the sense that I still believe that realpolitik did play a role, even though it was sold to the American people and NATO sold it to their partnership on the basis of a humanitarian intervention to stop a slaughter of civilians in Benghazi. And after all, Gaddafi had said he would do it. He said that there were insects and roaches and whatever. And he'd made it pretty clear that it would have been a bloody retribution there. I would have thought, though, that had that happened, in other words, had the intervention not taken place, and had Gaddafi gone ahead and done what he threatened to do, he would become an international pariah. He would be victorious, but he would be facing sanctions from the West, and there'd be no way that in the world that any Western government could deal with him. But that wouldn't mean that the Chinese and the Russians wouldn't jump in and make all kinds of oil deals, particularly the Chinese, who make no bones about dealing with Myanmar and Sudan and other unsavory regimes.
I mean, I think a lot of it comes down to is how does a regime have power? And obviously military power was one way of overcoming Gaddafi, and it proved, at least eventually, to be effective. But I still believe there are some options in terms of a combination of international sanctions and of civilian resistance that may indeed have worked. Because the Chinese and Russians, they did not veto the initial UN Security Council resolution. I think they're upset that NATO went well so far beyond the mandate of the UN. But the very fact that they allowed this thing to go through, I think, was indicative that even in their view, Gaddafi had gone too far.
What do you think, though, of the general, how this intervention and particularly the critiques on the left are sitting with, in other words, I often ask myself why the left is so small in this country and doesn't reach out to the center and doesn't have much traction. And I'm wondering now whether the fact that there's still voices on the left defending Gaddafi, if you consider Hugo Chavez and people like that,
right.
Credible sources, this to me is really could be a time where a lot of people on the left are being totally discredited.
Certainly, I think in many ways is indicative of just how U.S. policy in the region has so shattered U.S. credibility. The very fact that the United States has supported and Israel and its killings of 700, 800 civilians in Gaza Strip in early 2009 and just a couple years before that, a similar number in Lebanon. And he had this overwhelming bipartisan majority of Congress claiming it was legitimate self-defense. And then, of course, the atrocities and lies around Iraq. I mean, there's a degree of skepticism that's gone beyond healthy skepticism, but the one to cynicism that rules out even the possibility of the right to protect humanitarian intervention. And fortunately, I think what comes out of Libya is a mixed bag. I mean, a lot of it will depend on what happens in the coming weeks or months, whether there will be a stable democratic transition. But I think there's also the fact that it did take as long as it did, that the number of overall people killed in the war may arguably have surpassed what might have transpired if Gaddafi had gone ahead and reconquered Benghazi. I think this is still going to be debated, and I think there's some good arguments to be made by each side. I would just encourage listeners to maintain a healthy skepticism, but at the same time, not fall into this kind of simplistic critique, especially on the oil situation. I mean, Gaddafi had great great deals with these Western oil companies, Total, NEI, BP. I mean, they were making lots of money off of Libya. He was real happy to deal with him. The Western nations did not need to overthrow him simply to have access to the oil, because they had access to the oil already. It's far more a complex, you know, situation. I think either the knee-jerk defenders or the knee-jerk supporters of the NATO military action would like to make it sound.
The one thing, though, that bothers me about the left, and in the sense that it may be opening itself up to be discredited, and I'd like to get your insight into this, because it troubles me that many of these revolutions that are happening now with the Arab Spring are working class revolutions. Look at Syria, for example. The revolt against the Assad started in the poorest town, Diriyah, and all the suburbs of Damascus, where the resentment and the resistance is and the support for the revolution is, are the working class neighborhoods. And it's true in Libya, as you just mentioned. It's the eastern part of Libya that's all the working class that welcome the rebels, and they're able to move in so quickly.
And the working class neighborhoods in Tripoli were the center of the final uprising.
Exactly.
I mean, it's ironic because, you know, Libya and Syria do engage in kind of socialist rhetoric, but in fact, these are the regimes that had pretty much bought off the middle class and more elite elements. And the rebellion, both countries have been centered very much among the poor and working class.
Against the elite,
and the
people in Tripoli that support Gaddafi still are the trickle down cronies, and the same with the Assad cronies. So again, it makes you wonder. Here we are in this country where we can have a vigorous leftist critique against the Koch brothers, but why would anybody support these Assads and Gaddafis who are even worse?
Oh, no, they're very much so. I mean, I think many people on the American left have sort of adopted the very saying that is common in the Arab world: the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And that, but of course, anti-Western imperialist does not necessarily mean left. It can be, these repressive, bureaucratic, personalist regimes that unfortunately end up causing a reaction. I mean, I think if Libya does move into a more neoliberal direction, the post-Gaddafi era, I think it will be not as much a result of NATO intervention as it is, as we saw in Eastern Europe. People, there'll be a tendency for people just to want to flip to the other direction. If what they experience is supposedly socialism, they want anything but. but that remains to be seen. I mean, I'm in many ways I'm less though I am skeptical in many aspects of the NATO intervention. What I'm more concerned about, in fact, is what NATO is going to do in the post Gaddafi era. How much the United States and the Western European countries are going to try to shape the post-Gaddafi order, and I'm concerned that many of the brave Libyans who risk all to overthrow this tyrant are going to be pushed aside by certain new elites that Western powers will cultivate. I mean, I think this is the this is what I think the left needs to have some thoughtful critiques about.
And it's certainly something that would be so counterproductive and so counterintuitive on the part of the West, because this Libya has the fiercest anti-colonial political DNA of most countries in the Middle East and North Africa.
Yeah, I mean, the Italian colonial conquest was among the most brutal in Africa or the Middle East. And and that's one of the reasons I was actually skeptical around the intervention, because I was afraid that Gaddafi would use that to justify to get people to rally around the flag, and to a certain degree that he was successful, but I think the Libyans, I think we need to underscore whether or not one supported the NATO intervention, that this was indeed a popular revolution. And so I think the main task for international solidarity, if you will, would be to support efforts by the Libyan people to determine their own future, and not to allow this opening as a result of the overthrow of Gaddafi. Well, I think it's certainly a good thing to be used as an entree for undue Western influence.
So just to, in the last few minutes, then, to turn Stephen Zunis again, Professor of Politics and International Studies at the University of San Francisco, where he chairs the program in Middle East Studies. We were talking earlier about the Syrian revolution and how it's basically a working-class revolution, as indeed the Libyan revolution is, in the sense that it's the poor who want to overthrow these dictators, and it's the wealthy elites that want them to stay in place because of the crony capitalism trickle-down that they enjoy. But when we talk about cynicism about the motives of the West in Libya, I don't think that holds a candle to the cynicism involved in and around Syria, because there's clearly ambivalence on the part of Israel, for example. They don't see, and there's certain ambivalence on the part of the West. And frankly, Obama has been forced into these sanctions. This is not something, you know, if we were seeing pictures of the slaughter that goes on in the streets of Syria, I think the situation would be different. So I find this situation very, very cynical. And given that the Iranians are the ones that are sending in their Guards Corps to prop up the Syrian secret police and propping up the Assad's to the tune of about $7 billion at the moment, it makes you wonder about our kind of duplicity and double standards.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I in certain ways, I think, given the history of the United States in Syria, everything from when the Reagan administration were attacking Syrian armed forces in Syria, the Syria Accountability Act, which was the most one of the most ridiculous pieces of legislation passed in recent years. I mean, obviously there was legitimate concerns about Syria's overbearing role in Lebanon, but this went way beyond that to clearly designed to to encourage greater U.S.-Israeli hegemony in the region. I mean, our whole history with Syria is such that the opposition, unlike in Libya, has been very clear. They do not want Western intervention. They also have maintained their nonviolent discipline, because despite the incredible atrocities, the movement is still growing, and the regime is weakening. And they believe that, as I do, that eventually they will be victorious. So I'm really hoping that whether it be government policy or the position of the left, that we trust the people of these countries to determine their own future, and that we to underscore the fact that whether it be pro-Western regimes, like Egypt and Tunisia, Yemen, Bahrain, or historically anti-Western regimes like Syria and Libya, people want freedom. People want social justice. Now, this is a universal kind of thing, and I think it is wrong for both Western governments and elements of the left to try to decide whether or not they're going to support freedom based on some cynical geopolitical calculation.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Stephen Zunis. I enjoyed the conversation.
Me too.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Stephen Zunis, who is a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, where he chairs the program in Middle East Studies. He serves as a senior policy analyst for the Foreign Policy in Focus project of the Institute for Policy Studies. He's an associate editor of Peace Review, a contributing editor of Tikkun, and chair of the Academic Advisory Committee for the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.